The Good Christian, or Sermons on the Chief Christian Virtues by Father Francis Hunault, Imprimatur, Bishop James D. Ricard, copyright 1891. On Fidelity to God in Joy and in Sorrow, preached on the fourth Sunday after Easter. Because I have spoken these things to you, sorrow hath filled your heart. St. John 16:6. Introduction. Such was the way in which our Lord acted towards his disciples. Sometimes he filled them with joy and consolation, as when he showed them his glory on Mount Tabor. Sometimes he caused them sorrow and trouble, as when he suffered a shameful death on Mount Calvary. Soon again he rejoiced them by appearing to them after the resurrection, and a short time after that he again filled them with sorrow when he left them and ascended into heaven. And so it is with us, too, in the world, my dear brethren, as daily experience teaches us. There are mixtures prepared for us, as Synesius so well remarks. There is a constant alternation of sweetness and bitterness, prosperity and adversity. In the morning one is good-humored and cheerful, in the evening he is sad and melancholy. Today he enjoys the society of a good friend, tomorrow he has to contend with a bitter enemy. This week he has the greatest happiness in his family, and next, one of his loved ones is taken away by death. This year, he says in a cheerful tones, I have made a good deal of profit. The next year he sighs, oh, how unfortunate I am, what fearful losses I have had. Now his cry is, God be praised, I am well and in good health. Soon after, you may hear him lamenting and complaining of the pain he has to suffer. Now he exclaims, how fortunate that my plan succeeded so well. Alas, he cries out a short time after, I know not what to do or where to turn to for help. Thus the mixtures are prepared for us. Thus divine providence plays with us mortals and mingles sorrow with sweet, prosperity with adversity. But what is the object of that change and alteration? It is, answers St. Bernard, to try us and see whether we have a well-founded virtue and whether we really love our God with our whole heart. This is a consolation for you, pious servants of God, who lead holy lives and yet have many trials and crosses to bear. God sends them to you to try and to increase your virtue, as I shall now prove. Plan of Discourse. To remain steadfast in virtue and in the love of God in sorrow as well as in joy, in adversity as well as in prosperity, constitutes the true virtue and piety of Christians. Such is the whole subject. That we may all endeavor to possess such virtue, grant us thy grace, O Teacher of Truth. We ask it of thee through the intercession of Mary and of our holy angel guardians. When man is always prosperous and serves God faithfully, we might easily look on his virtue somewhat suspicious and say of him what Satan said of Job to the Lord. Thou art proud of thy servant, but without reason. Thou hast surrounded him with blessings. Why then should he not praise and bless thee? But his praise is not sincere. It is only lip service. On the other hand, if a man has constantly to contend with suffering and adversity, and still remains devout and pious, even then we might have reason to suspect him and to say, his devotion does not come from the heart. It is only forced. He prays to be free from his miseries, or else, since he can find no consolation on earth, he is compelled to seek it from God. Therefore, to leave no room for doubt, God generally mingles sorrow with joy, prosperity with adversity, so as to come at the truth of the matter and see what a man's virtue really is. If he remains constant and steadfast in both circumstances, then it is bound to be honest and sincere. And in the first place, It is a beautiful proof of great virtue to love God and remain true to Him in the midst of crosses and trials. Therefore, in many places in the Holy Scriptures, love is compared with gold and adversity with fire. Thus Job says of himself, "He hath tried me as gold that passes through the fire." Gold and silver are tried in the fire, says the wise Ecclesiasticus, but acceptable men in the furnace of humiliation to see whether their piety is sincere or not. And in truth, it is something wonderful to love one who deals harshly with us. A friend in need is a friend indeed, says the old proverb. And if true friendship is proved in the time of necessity, how much more will not its sincerity be evident if the very one by whom the need is caused is still loved? Men are sometimes scandalized at this in their own minds. They are surprised to see a pious servant of God bending under the weight of many severe trials and miseries, as if they thought that God should not thus torture a soul that loves him, or else that the soul itself was not acting wisely in remaining true to him and in praising and blessing him in spite of the torments he inflicts on it. When Job was reduced to the drearest poverty and had to sit in the dunghill covered with sores, his only word was, "Blessed be the name of the Lord." But his wife mocked and jeered at him. "Dost thou still continue in thy simplicity?" she said. "Bless God and die." When the old Tobias was unfortunate, his wife, too, showed just as little sympathy for him. "It is evident," said she, "thy hope is come to nothing, and thy alms now appear. Thy blindness should teach thee how vain is thy reliance on God, and thou shouldest now acknowledge that thy alms have been of little good to thee." But such people do not understand the benefit of adversity. And this very circumstance brings into still clearer light the great virtue of those who remain steadfast in the service of God in the time of trial. For being more enlightened, they see that the sufferings that God sends them are nothing but proofs of His love and real benefits, for which they therefore thank Him and love Him all the more. But if I have to speak out my mind on the matter, I agree with St. Augustine and St. Ambrose that it is a far more difficult and rare thing to love God sincerely in the time of prosperity, when all our wishes are fulfilled, than when we have to suffer. How so? Although prosperity should impel a generous mind to sentiments of gratitude, although temporal goods, such as health, riches, honors, the esteem of men, the lawful pleasures that are not evil in themselves, but rather opportunities given us to further the glory of God and to help others, yet, on account of the corruption of our nature, they expose our virtue to far greater dangers than trials and crosses do, because the latter draw the heart, as it were, violently from creatures and force it to turn to the Creator, while the former cause the heart and mind to become attached to creatures and to neglect the Creator. Adversity takes away from man many occasions of sin, but prosperity brings with it all that inflames our bad desires and leads us into sin. It is, then, a great and difficult virtue to be prosperous, and yet not to allow our prosperity to get the upper hand, to contend against it, and not to be overcome in the struggle, as St. Augustine says. It is extremely difficult to be in an honorable position, and yet to be outwardly and inwardly humble, to be rich, and yet to be poor in spirit, to have abundance of everything, and yet not to transgress the bounds of moderation, to be in the midst of pleasures, and yet to keep one's senses in check by mortification. It is a great virtue indeed to be pious in prosperity. In fact, says St. Gregory, it seems much easier to bear adversity patiently than to avoid losing one's soul in prosperity. The prudent and far-seeing Emperor Galba, when giving instructions to Guizot whom he had designed to make his successor, added amongst others the following: "You have not yet had experience of all dangers. Up to the present, you have only had adverse fortune to bear, and there is no great difficulty in that. It is only when you ascend the throne that your trials will really commence, for then you will have to show the world that you are a brave and determined man. Prosperity proves our continency much more than adversity, for miseries we bear, but we are corrupted by good fortune." The virtuous and heroic Catherine, the wife of Henry VIII, King of England, who has left behind her a reputation for the greatest patience and virtue. When she was divorced by her impious husband and thrown into prison, used to say, "I do not wish for too great prosperity, nor too much suffering in this world, because each has its dangers, temptations, and difficulties. But if I had to choose between them, then should I prefer the greatest misery to the greatest good fortune, because, while those who suffer are deprived of consolation, they who are in prosperity are nearly always blinded by their success and perverted." Mark those words, suffering Christians. You often sigh and wish to be freed from your domestic crosses. "Would that I were in good health," you exclaim. "Would that I were not so poor and miserable. How zealously I should serve my God, and what good I should do my neighbor." My good friends, you do not know what you wish. It is not indeed impossible to be pious and virtuous in prosperity, but it is a rare and difficult thing. Truly, it is a great virtue to love God in prosperity, but it is a far more certain virtue to love Him in adversity. But without disputing any longer on this point, since men are wont to do wrong in both circumstances, the truth of my proposition is made evident at all events, namely, that the virtue of that man is certainly the greatest who, being proved in both ways, always remains faithful to God, so that he is neither elated by prosperity nor cast down by adversity. He serves his God as zealously when things go according to his wishes as when everything turns out a failure with him. Like St. Paul, he knows how to enjoy abundance and to suffer want with the same equanimity. Whether he laughs with joy or weeps in sorrow, he is still true to his love for God. Whether he is poor or rich, sick or healthy, despised or honored, sad or joyful, in a word, whatever may be his circumstances, he is always the same with regard to his duty to God. "There," says St. Bernard, "you have a patron of perfect and sincere virtue. For one of that kind shows that he has a right appreciation of God and of created things. He proves that he esteems nothing outside of God, that he looks on God as his only true good, with whom he alone is satisfied, that he does not desire temporal goods, health, comfort, pleasure, riches, honors, or the esteem of men, nor use them unless, in so far as they help him to offer to God an acceptable service according to the divine will and decree. Hence, it is a matter of indifference to him whether he has those things or not, whether he gains or loses them. If God gives them to him, he accepts them with gratitude, but his whole heart and love still belong to God. If his health is taken from him by sickness, his joy by some trouble, his money by misfortune, his good name by disgrace, his pleasure by the death of some good friend, he is still satisfied with his God and continues to serve him with as much zeal as ever. And that is the way to keep the chief commandment of the law: Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with thy whole heart, and with thy whole soul, and with thy whole mind. St. Bernard says, "Not to become perverted from the service of God by the caresses of prosperity, nor to be deterred from it by adversity, that is to love him with our whole heart and soul and strength." So it was with Job, who, when he was the richest and greatest man in all the East, was looked on by God as his most faithful servant, who had not his own upon earth. And when he lost his children, his property, and his wealth at once, and was stricken with a grievous ulcer from head to foot, abandoned and jeered at by his best friends, still remained faithful to God. In all of these things, says the Scripture, Job sinned not by his lips, nor spoke he any foolish thing against God. In all his troubles, not a word of sinful complaint escaped him. All he had to say was, if we have received good things at the hand of God, why should we not receive evil? The Lord gave, and therefore I have always blessed his holy name. The Lord hath taken away, as it hath pleased the Lord, so is it done. Blessed be the name of the Lord. So it was with the saintly King Louis of France, who in the midst of royal honors and riches led a pious and holy life. He was once routed in battle by the Saracens and taken prisoner. And what do you think he did, my dear brethren, when this great misfortune befell him? When he was brought to the room he was to occupy as a prisoner, he took his breviary into his hand, and without the least change of countenance, just as if he were in his own palace in Paris, began to read the office which he had not yet finished for the day. So it was, listen to this, young women, with Seraphina Colina at Massara writes in her life. She belonged to a rich and noble family, and although she was in the midst of worldly joys, yet showed from her earliest years that one can serve God by leading a holy life even in the greatest prosperity. But she was not long without the cross. She married a certain count, a most wicked man, who treated her like a servant, compelled her to receive his concubine with every mask of respect, beat and abused her unmercifully, and at last put her away as an adulteress, and shut her up in a convent of poor clares. Think of what this noble lady must have suffered from such treatment, while there are many who cannot bear even a cross look from their husbands. Seraphina, what dost thou think of thy lot? Wert thou still satisfied with God, who sent thee such hard trials? Truly, she was. Her heart and her love were centered in God as before. In the midst of her sore troubles, her only prayer was, God, strengthen me, that I may bear all according to thy will. I will relate for you still another example of fidelity to God in prosperity and adversity, which was exhibited to the world in the year 1703 and is recorded by Father Joseph Parola of our society. Listen to this, you gentlemen. Charles of Carniato, Marquis of Bernasco, who has imperial blood in his veins, was related to the greatest sovereigns of Europe, was the chief man of the court of Turin, lieutenant general of the army, governor of many provinces and fortresses, and had been entrusted by the king with the administration of the affairs of the kingdom. In the midst of his good fortune, as the very summit of honors and dignities, in the greatest abundance of wealth and riches, this nobleman showed that one can be great in the eyes of the world, and at the same time in the sight of God. He was a model of all Christian virtues, so that he might well put to shame many a religious by his steadfast piety. He placed God and his holy law before all created things, and this was the only rule by which he managed all his affairs, submitting them and himself completely to the divine will. Do you wish to hear a proof of the genuineness and sincerity of his virtue? Mark, then, how he acted in the time of adversity. He was smitten by the hand of God, almost like another Job. Seven of his sons died one after the other. Oh, what a sore blow for a father, and such a rich father. And yet he looked on with unchanged countenance and undisturbed peace of mind, as if he were not a whit concerned. His eighth son alone remained to him as the heir of his name and the future hope of his family, but even he was carried off by a sudden death in the Father's absence. Imagine how the Father's heart was torn with grief. A priest, an intimate friend of his, visited him to console him, but when he saw no change or sign of sorrow in the countenance of the Marquis, he thought that perhaps the latter was hiding his grief so as not to allow it to appear outwardly, and therefore he exhorted him to indulge his sorrow for a time and to relieve himself in that way. Charles turned to him and smiled. "I have done what you suggest," he said. The words, "May the will of God be done," have completely assuaged my grief. But his troubles were not yet at an end. A grievous illness attacked him soon after and confined him to bed, causing him most fearful agony and completely crippling him so that he could not stir hand or foot. Hot and poisonous humors coursed through his veins, torturing his whole body, and he was not even able to turn from one side to the other. For 7 whole years he lay in this miserable state, suffering with the most heroic patience, and never letting a word of complaint escape his lips. "May the will of God be done," was his sole consolation during the whole time. Ah, Christians, what do we think of this? Are we not forced to sigh deeply and to acknowledge that the virtue of those great people was indeed rare in prosperity as well as in adversity? So it is. They proved that they loved God with their whole heart and soul above all things and in all circumstances. But how is it with us in this respect? The Holy Ghost says by the wise man, "A holy man continueth in wisdom as the sun." He who loves God sincerely still continues to love, whether he is prosperous or the reverse. He is like the sun that never changes its light, whether it is thrown on dung or on gold. But a fool is changed as the moon. Mark this simile. Astronomers tell us that when the moon shows her dark side to the earth, she throws all her light upwards towards heaven. On the other hand, when her dark side is turned towards heaven, we enjoy all her light here on earth. Thus she never sheds her light equally on heaven and on earth, but as her light is withdrawn from us, it increases in heaven, and as it is withdrawn from heaven, it increases on earth. A fool is changed as the moon. Is it not so with a greater number of us, my dear brethren? When some find the star of their fortunes darkened by trials and calamities, so that they are deprived of all earthly joy and consolation, they send the rays of their love to heaven, they seek God and adore Him. But when the darkness vanishes, when their trials come to an end, and the full light of prosperity shines on them, oh, how they then withdraw their light from heaven. They forget their Creator, their love, which now attaches itself to creatures and temporal things, grows cold towards God and heavenly goods. Many a one living in lowly poverty and working hard to support himself and his family is truly humble, meek, merciful, modest, zealous in prayer, diligent in the performance of his morning and evening devotions, in frequenting the sacraments, in hearing sermons, and in the practice of all the other virtues. But if his fortune begins to smile on him, if he grows rich, or happens to be raised to some honorable position, then, humility, where art thou? Modesty, what has become of thee? Devotion, where hast thou vanished to? Ah, how soon those things are forgotten, and how quickly the usages of the world are learned, and its vanities and practices adopted. Nay, ye will see many a one who after marriage fixes all his love on a creature, and hardly ever makes his appearance in church, as if he were one of the guests mentioned in the gospel, who said, "I have married a wife, and therefore I cannot come." A fool is changed as the moon, so inconstant and fickle are we. Others act in a way quite opposite to that. In the time of prosperity, they are cheerful and resigned to the will of God. They praise and bless Him, and say with joyful hearts, Lord, thy will be done. But if they are visited by some affliction, if the husband or wife is attacked by illness, if a dear child dies, if they are disappointed of some legacy they hope for, if they lose an important lawsuit, if they fail in their undertakings, if they are put to shame or have some other trial to bear, then there is an end of their resignation and contentment. God is no longer pleasing to them. Their trouble and chagrin are so great that they cannot pray. Oh, what a heavy cross, they exclaim. How have I deserved it from God? They think no more of their former prosperity and of the blessing that God bestowed on them so richly in preference to so many others. A fool is changed as the moon. Whence comes this inconstancy? Ah, from the want of true virtue and a sincere love of God. We have not yet given ourselves to Him without reserve. We do not love Him with our whole heart and soul and strength above all things. Otherwise, we should be the same to Him in all circumstances, in prosperity and adversity, no matter what He does with us, so that if we were asked, what do you wish? What do you desire on earth? We should be able to answer with truth, I wish and desire nothing else but what God wills and how God wills. That is a difficulty, you think, and you are right. But we must endeavor to learn this difficult virtue, and we can learn it if we frequently think of our last end, of the reason why we are on this earth, which is none other than to love God and to be happy with Him forever. Therefore, we must look on it as certain that all created goods, whatever be their names, such as riches, honors, pleasures, health, the love and friendship of men, are not real goods. And we must be fully convinced that all adverse circumstances, whenever they may be, such as sickness, natural sorrow, poverty, loss of good name, abandonment by men, have not the least particle of true evil in them, but that our true good, for which we have to strive, is the possession of God here on earth by grace, and hereafter in heaven by vision. This one supreme good I can possess whether I am healthy or sick, poor or rich, joyful or sorrowful. Therefore, I have nothing on earth to fear, hope for, or love but God. And in all circumstances, God must be the object of my greatest love and esteem. Let us keep this in mind in the daily alterations of joy and sorrow to which we are exposed, and accept those trifling changes from the hand of God, offering them up to Him, as I have explained more at length when treating of conformity to the will of God. Thus, we shall gradually learn how to be the same towards God, even in changes of greater importance. May God grant us the grace to do that. Amen.